Well, folks, the music doesn't want to play. All right, so, okay. I think we all heard the intro, the three-minute intro. We've changed our format. We're going to have our three-minute breaks before the shows, and we will handle the any other breaks live on the air. So welcome. This is Bloodlines here on Eurofolk Radio, and today is January 21st, 2018. And today's topic is going to be German derived from Hebrew. But we're going to first go back to what we were talking about last week from this article here, BritishIsrael.us. And as soon as Pastor Steve, are you with us?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. And as soon as I post this in the chat room, for people, so people can follow along, we're going to finish what we started last week on the British Israel website regarding the derivation of English from Hebrew. Okay, and so I'm going to go right to that website real quick here because we were in the middle of the section entitled "Was Runic Derived from Hebrew?" Okay. And we had gone through about half of this paragraph, and I'll just pick it up about near the bottom of the paragraph. The Phoenician slash Hebrew Lamed, and that is correct. Phoenician and Hebrew are so closely related. The alphabets are exactly the same. The pronunciations are the same. But the vast majority of philologists, especially of the Jewish and academic persuasion, falsely teach that Phoenician is older than Hebrew. That's impossible. It's absolutely impossible because the country of Phoenicia did not exist until much later in Hebrew history, okay? And the Phoenicians were, in fact, Israelites of the northern tribes of the Palestinian area, okay?
They were the seafarers.
They were the seafarers, absolutely. And they became known as the Finns in Finland. We discussed this a couple of shows ago, the Israelite origin of the Finnish people. All right, the Phoenician Hebrew Lamed is a whip, rod, or goad. The runic lagu has the form of a whip, the symbol of authority in Egyptian hieroglyphics. Its meaning is law. Okay, so I think we're talking about the letter L here, as we know it today, the letter L.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Lamed.
Lamed, okay. And so it survives in the runes of Northern Europe. You know, the Danes, the Swedes, the Vikings, etc., which proves that the runes, the Nordic runes, derive also from the Phoenician and from the Hebrew. Okay? There's no differentiation. There is no such thing as a Indo-Aryan language that excludes the Hebrew. That is a false designation. It's in all of your academic philology books, and it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. That's one of the purposes of us doing these shows, is to prove the errors of the, you know, of academics.
We debunk a lot of stuff here.
Yeah. The last three shows, we debunked all of this, you know, academic nonsense because they believe that the Jews are Hebrews and Jews don't look like Aryans. So therefore, they make the false conclusion that Hebrew and Aryan languages are different. No, the Jews aren't Hebrews. The Jews aren't Hebrews, nor are they Israelites. And so you believe Jewish lies and you jump to false conclusions. Okay, in any case, it actually goes back to the symbol of authority in Egyptian hieroglyphics. Its meaning is law. Kalk has the form of a thunderbolt. Okay?
You know, I'm getting a private message from some idiot.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know how to disable that, but that's
okay.
All right.
Yeah. Kalk has the form of a thunderbolt. I think the letter N looks like a little like a thunderbolt, right? The Aryan thunderbolt, okay, which characterizes the Nin in the Assyrian sculptures. And when his title Kalkhala, sounds very much like Valhalla to me, brother of the lightning, and the name of his father's sacred city, Kalkha, are considered, we must conclude that the word signified what the form of the character denotes. Stan, S-T-A-N, has the form in which the Phoenicians cast their pigs of tin. A pig of tin is a casting. It's not in the shape of a pig.
That's right. It's called a pig. Like a pig, iron. A pig.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's a casting. And is stamped as a symbol on one so formed. So they put the letter Stan on one of these, you know, before it hardened, of course. They stamped it with this letter, found in Cornwall and now in Truro Museum. It is therefore extremely probable that the word, like the Latin stanum, means tin. Lastly, the runic copulative sign has precisely the ancient form of vau, which means hook, and as such became in Hebrew the copulative conjunction, which would be and in English, A-N-D. What's the pronunciation of the word for and in Hebrew, Pastor Steve? Is it
and?
Vav?
With, mean.
Okay. How do you pronounce and in Hebrew? Jacob and, what's that? Vamim?
No, mean. M-I-N.
Min. M-I-N. Min. Okay. Uh-huh.
The letter W.
Okay.
With the attached.
So that gets us closer to vow, V-A-W. So you could see from w to wow, or vow, is not that much of a stretch.
Well, it's the letter. The letter is named Waw.
Okay. So the actual letter is named Waw, not vow, which is apparently the runic variation.
They've translated a lot of that as a V.
Mm-hmm. Which is a common changeover from Hebrew into, say, Latin and German, I believe, too. I think the W is pronounced as a V in German. So we see that these subtle changes in language, we can see that the connection to Hebrew is there. He continues, thus we see that the Phoenician alphabet and the Anglo-Saxon Futhoric, and Futhoric is simply the runic language, are derived from a common source, that the same feeling dictated the choice of the symbols, meaning, although he says feeling, I would use the word meaning, which were to be used as letters in each case, and that each letter represents the initial sound of the name of the corresponding symbol. It must be remembered that the regular square Hebrew type was a comparatively late invention.
That is correct. Hebrew is the most recent, and it has been seriously tampered with by the Jews.
And it's a Jewish invention. It's a Jewish invention. And that the early Phoenician Hebrew forms were those familiar to the Israelites of the captivity of 721 BC. We had talked briefly in one of the chat rooms. I had questioned the origin of the word dur, D-U-R. I think it was part of this article. And somebody suggested that in Welsh it's spelled D-W-R and that it means water. Okay. The word water is almost consistent throughout the entire planet. The wah sound like agua.
Yeah, but in Hebrew it's mayim.
Mayim. Okay. So you got the A-Y, and remember we talked about sometimes the Hebrew was written left to right as well as right to left. And so you can get changes of...
When they were using the booster feed on, right?
That's right. And so that's why that explains why some of the words in English, and we'll find out also in German, are pronounced backwards from the Hebrew, okay? And as the language expanded, they probably used this as a tool to create new words, okay? But you can see their origin in the Hebrew as being spelled backwards, okay? So he continues, comparing Hebrew Phoenician with runic suggests that runic consisted of old Hebrew letters. All right, all you white nationalists and pagans out there, are you listening? Let me repeat this. Comparing Hebrew Phoenician with runic suggests that runic consisted of whole old Hebrew letters. There are many cases where the very same form is used for two different letters in Hebrew and runic. Isaac Taylor, oh, but getting back to the word dwr, or if it's pronounced with a dwr, the Welsh word for water, but the same person said that the Welsh word for sea is mor, M-O-R. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but as in French, it's mer. And also in German, mer, meaning sea. Okay? Mm-hmm. So we'll probably find that these are also variations of the Hebrew. Anyway, he continues. Now we're getting into the migrations. Isaac Taylor, in his work on the runic characters, accounts for the spread of runic characters from the Black Sea to the Baltic by saying that the Goths were formerly Getae. Okay, the Goths, meaning God's people, Gotish, is what
Gotish,
the...
Yes.
Yeah, the Gotish, God's people. And only the Israelites referred to themselves as God's people. Okay?
That's right.
All right, okay. So here we see again that the runic characters migrated along with the Israelite migration. The runic came to the north from Asgard, a place which Taylor identifies with the Garros of Herodotus, okay? Germán. There was a town called Kerman, K-E-R-M-A-N-N, in that area. So we're getting the Garros. Now, what does ger mean in Hebrew, Pastor Steve?
I was looking up sea here.
Okay.
And what I have is 3220 yam.
Okay.
That's the Hebrew for sea, and it means to roar.
Mm-hmm.
The roar of the sea, so the yam.
Okay. And maybe that's where the R comes from the roaring sound of the sea, that you get dur and mer. Okay, so the am sound is there, and it's recorded as an M.
Well, like Yam Suf.
Yam Suf.
That sea of reeds.
Okay. Yam Suf. Very good. All right, so we see all these Hebrew connections. Asgard with Garros, and the Hebrew word ger means kinsman. Okay. Mm-hmm. So a German and the word German means kinsman, right? A kinsman of an Israelite is what the actual word German means. This theory supports the statement of Snorri.
Well,
go ahead.
Ger means sojourner.
Okay, but it's always a reference to a related, a kinsman sojourner. It's not a racial. It's a racial
or stranger.
Right.
A stranger, in other words, you're an Israelite from another Israelite
country.
Nation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're a ger.
Right. That means
sojourning like I'm an Israelite sojourning on the North American continent.
Right. Right. You're not a Nokri, which is supposed to be.
That is a racial alien.
That's a racial alien. Right. So a ger is actually a kinsman sojourning through your territory, but he's still an Israelite, or a person of the same race, at the very least, a person of the same race. All right, so he continues. This theory supports the statement of Snorri Sturluson that Odin introduced written characters into the north. Okay? Now, as an Israelite, actually descended from the tribe of Judah, Odin would have been literate. Okay? So Odin, descendant of Judah, migrated north with his clan, of Germans, and brought those runes into the north. So again, this proves our migration theory. mm-hmm. that the runic characters come from Hebrew and were transmitted to the north by Odin, the Israelite of the tribe of Judah. Odin produced a Futhoric alphabet whose runic characters bear a strange likeness to the characters used by the Greek colonists of the Black Sea littoral. Now, of course, we talked about last week that the Greeks are actually, the original Greeks were from Japheth, but the countries colonized by Japheth were ultimately overtaken by the Israelites of the dispersion, okay, and then ruled over by those Israelites. The Roman kings and queens were actually descended from Zerah-Judah, so were the Brits, and so were the Irish, okay, mm-hmm. taken over by Zerah-Judah. So, we see the migration patterns of these languages match the actual migration, literal migration patterns of us going through Europe. Okay? He continues, characters which can be traced back as far as that coin of King Geta of the Edoni by the river Strymon in Thrace. Thrace would be more closer to Italy, I believe, right? Between Greece and Italy, somewhere like that. The identical coin that found its way into the bed of the river Euphrates near Babylon. Goth is undoubtedly derived from Guta Theod. Theod being Old English for a people. All right? So, kinsmen people. All right?
Yes.
The Teutz. Theod, Teut. Teut, Deutschland. The land of the Germans. Teut. Deutsch means people, okay? Goth, mm-hmm. therefore, means the people of Guta. Very interesting. So it's, again, a reference to a king, King Geta of the Edoni. Just as the word Cimmerian is a Greekified version.
Cimri,
yeah. Cimri, right? Cimri. Mm-hmm. King Omri.
Right.
Okay. So the word Cimmerioi, as it was pronounced by the Greeks, Cimmerioi, is a reference to the Israelites under the rule of King Omri. So here mm-hmm. we see Goth is a reference to the Israelites under King Geta. And that's where they get, okay. or Gauta, which was actually a common...
Guta,
yeah,
Guta Theod.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. We met a people of Gutium on the inscriptions of Cyrus. The Getae of Trajan's column have an appearance and dress that is identical to the frescoes of the captive Goths from the Constantinople column, even though centuries apart. And one of their common weapons was the battle axe, and that was the weapon of the Israelites. Okay, you see depictions of the Goths. They were just like the dress of the Israelites, except that since they wandered farther north, they had to wear skins of animals to keep warm. Okay, so the further north.
Well, that's under getting, and they wound up all the Vikings and all the seafaring raiders. Their one of their main weapons was the battle axe. It's indicative of our people.
That's right.
You know, that's the right. whole thing. You are my battle axe and weapons of war.
And so the Nordic runes are, contrary to popular opinion, are proof of their Israelite Hebrew origin, not the opposite. Okay? Next section. Did Jesus speak Hebrew? In Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History, 339:16, Papias says, quote, Matthew composed his history in the Hebrew dialect, and everyone translated it as he was able. Now, this is very interesting.
Correct.
It's very interesting because most of your theologians, Bible theologians, insist that the Gospels were written in Greek. So Papias contradicts this right here. He says,
absolutely.
Okay.
And Yeshua spoke Aramaic. He spoke Aramaic, which is almost identical
mm-hmm. to the Hebrew.
With the Hebrew, except for slight pronunciation differences
right.
and a little spelling.
And a good comparison would be that the Hebrew is like the High German to the Aramaic as High German is to Low German. Okay? it became the popular dialect of, let's say the unlearned, okay,
mm-hmm.
the common vulgar speech, as it used to be called, the Vulgate, the Latin Vulgate, was composed yeah. in the common language, not the high language, okay? Apparently, the Greek versions of Matthew, Mark, and Luke are not originals. All right, so this is, if what Papias says is true, then that last sentence would follow. If they were
we have only fragments of a lot of the Brit Chadasha, the New Testament.
Uh-huh.
But it was all written in Hebrew at one time. We don't have those documents extant today because of deterioration.
Mm-hmm.
Damage. There yes. may be some that the Catholic Church have and are suppressed.
Right.
They have volumes that they're yeah. They're hiding.
Yes.
Because it would debunk their theology completely.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, remember yesterday or Friday, Professor Truth told us that one of his associates was actually in the Vatican archives and saw some of these things that the Vatican is hiding from the world.
Well, he's lucky if he's alive.
That's right.
Man.
Yeah, well, he was a government operative at the time. So not anymore. Anyway, continuing, there was a Hebrew original of Matthew that has been lost, as you just said. Some scholars have mistakenly claimed that the word for Hebrew should be understood as Aramaic. The article, that's obviously ridiculous, okay? I'm sure you agree, you know, that Hebrew, or Aramaic is a derivative of Hebrew, and that's the only way it can be understood.
Actually, they were from Aram originally.
Okay, okay.
You have to remember.
And he was a person, he was another person.
They were from that area, and Terach was an Arami,
mm-hmm.
and Abraham left because his father was an idol worshiper.
Right.
But Abraham was from the land of Aram, and they migrated, and they moved all over.
Mm-hmm.
And then the language changed from Arami to Hebrew to Ibrith.
Okay, so distinguishing between the Hebrews and the Arameans, okay, because Aram was a literal.
All right. It's like American English and British English.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
So you're saying the Hebrew might actually have been derived from the Aramaic?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
Okay. Pastor,
well,
I get slapped in the face.
We came from Britain. We spoke British English mm-hmm. back in those days, and our language has evolved into what we speak today.
Right, right.
But the British have a different mode and pronunciation of speech, but it's basically the same language.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
So if Abram, who later became Abraham, was from Aram.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke Arami.
Mm-hmm.
And then it later evolved into the language of the Ibri from Eber, the Hebrews.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the language modified somewhat.
Somewhat.
It's not a drastic difference.
Right. And contrary to what secular people believe, both Aram and Eber were literal walking on the earth people. They actually lived,
yeah.
existed. Right?
Oh, absolutely.
There's always
Eber is the father of the Hebrews because it's Ibrim of
mm-hmm.
Eber.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the Hebrews.
That's Hebrews. Real people, just as Adam and Eve really lived. They walked on the face of the earth. Don't let anybody tell you
Adam
different.
Adam and Hawa, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. These are all fables told by secularists who are trying to debunk the Bible, and they've always been proven wrong in every single case. Okay? So, the article by Jay Grintz, Hebrew as the Spoken and Written Language in the Last Days of the Second Temple, Journal of Biblical Literature, has proved this claim false, namely that the Aramaic, what was the claim here? I forgot. It says, some scholars have mistakenly claimed that the word for Hebrew should be understood as Aramaic. So, they're different dialects, okay, and they cannot be 100% equated.
All right, you go down into London, and they'll speak a certain way. You go to Wales, they will speak a slightly different way. You go to Scotland or Ireland.
Oh, yeah, you can't even understand them.
And you will be nice, I'm Scottish.
oh, I forgot.
they speak... Mm-hmm. A different dialect. It's the same language, but a dialect. That's the whole deal.
Right. Yes. Yes, absolutely. It continues. It is true that three centuries before Jesus, Alexander the Great spread Greek culture and Greek ways throughout his empire, and the Greek language was widely spoken during New Testament times. But within the land of Israel, there was a strong resistance to pagan Hellenization. Yes, there was. Okay.
Yes, there was.
The letter of Aristeus is written in Greek. Interestingly, it explains that the spoken language of the Hebrew people in the land of Israel was Hebrew. Okay.
That's correct.
All right. While it would not be correct to say that Hebrew was the only language understood and spoken by the Israelite people during the time of Yahshua, there is abundant evidence that the people's holy books, prayer studies in the classroom, parables, and quite naturally then their everyday speech was in Hebrew.
All right, stop.
Okay.
Greek was the business language. It was used in business transactions. But when they went home, they spoke Hebrew. All right. There have been several languages in modern times.
Very interesting.
French was a business language for quite some time when the French Empire was great.
Yes.
English, American English is the business language. In certain areas in South America where they do a great deal of trade with Japan, Japanese is the business language. They speak their Spanish dialect and they speak Japanese because they're doing business with Japan all the time. They are great importers and exporters with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So it's different areas of the world use different business languages, but then there's the local dialect.
Yes.
So that's the difference right there.
Okay, so let's continue here. The letter of Aristeus is written in Greek, and of course we substitute Israel for Jew. The British Israel influence here is very strong, equating Jews with Israel. They should know better. And most actually do know better. It's just that they have to use that equation in order to satisfy the Rothschilds in London. Jesus clearly spoke Hebrew in Acts 26:14. Paul clearly spoke Hebrew in Acts 21 and 22, as we found out Friday, right? We did Acts chapter 22 last Friday on Yahweh's covenant people.
And then when
he spoke in real, true Hebrew, everybody stood up and listened, right?
Yep.
Okay, it caught their attention, all right? In John 5:2, now he was a Roman by citizenship, and therefore he must have spoken Latin very well, okay? Mm-hmm. That fact is overlooked by most scholars. So he was multilingual for sure.
Oh, okay. Absolutely.
Latin, Greek, Roman, I'm sorry, Hebrew and Aramaic. He would have been able to speak all four languages. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Gospel of Mark contains a few Aramaic words, and this was what misled scholars. Today, after the discovery of the Hebrew Ben Sira, Ecclesiasticus, of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and of the Bar Kokhba letters, it is accepted that most people were fluent in Hebrew. Thank you very much. Okay. That's confirming correct. What you just said, Pastor Steve. The Pentateuch was translated into... You're so smart. Folks, you have to understand the history of our people, that Hebrew was the common language of the Israelites. And, of course, correct. As you said, these other cultures, the Greek and the Romans, tried to change our habits. And that's probably why we see an incursion of Greek and Latin into the speech of all of the dispersion. Okay? They probably tried their best to retain their Hebrew and or Aramaic, and gradually, and we'll find out when we get to the German, we'll see that the Assyrians and the Syrians imposed a lot of their language on the Germanic Israelites. Okay? That we'll take that up in the second half of today's show. Okay. The Pentateuch was translated into Aramaic for the benefit of the lower strata of the population. The parables in rabbinic literature, on the other hand, were delivered in Hebrew at all periods, okay? And it's incorrect to call it rabbinic literature. Just call it Hebrew-Israelite literature. There are sayings of Jesus which can be rendered only into Hebrew. Very interesting. The Hebrew origins of the Gospels can therefore be demonstrated by retranslating them from Greek back into Hebrew. Paul's epistles were composed originally in Greek, but the terminology is still Hebrew. Now, Paul would have been an outsider, having grown up in Tarsus, okay, up in Turkey. So, therefore, his epistles may have been composed in Greek. But what the author is saying here is that the others, the Gospels, were composed in Hebrew, and those have since been lost. Okay? I'll just go one more paragraph here. With the exception of Matthew, a majority of Old Testament quotations found in the New Testament are from the Greek Septuagint. Yes, and they were using the Greek Septuagint in Gospel times. Why? Because Herod had destroyed a lot of the Hebrew documents. Herod was intent on destroying the Hebrew documents because he was an Edomite, and people.
Oh, absolutely!
Right, and the women of Israel were demonstrating on a daily basis against the Romans, saying, "Get rid of this Edomite. He's not one of us. He shouldn't be ruling over us." Okay, and therefore he destroyed the Hebrew records and probably turned whatever Hebrew scriptures were left. He probably turned them over to the Edomite rabbis, okay, so that they could impersonate us, all right, rather than the Hebrew Masoretic text. Now, he's got this wrong. Masoretic, this is anachronistic.
That's when the Jewish scribes invented all that stuff.
Right.
That Masoretic vowel points are Jewish.
That's right. That's right.
Not Israelite. They are not Hebrew. They are what they call Jews.
That's right. And the Masoretic text. The Masoretic text was not composed until around 1000 AD. It was compiled over that stretch of time. And the Septuagint was composed in 220, 250 BC by scribes of Judah, and they who translated the Hebrew directly into the Greek. And that's what was commonly available at the time. And we've done a couple shows showing that the Septuagint is more complete than the Masoretic text, the Jews having deleted, redacted a lot of the Old Testament. So if we didn't have the Greek Septuagint to go by, we wouldn't know that. That's why this Greek Septuagint is absolutely important, crucial to understanding how
well,
the Bible...
Well, you have to use all of the different versions. The same way the book of Yashar, Sefer HaYashar, fills in a lot of stuff that's not in the King James, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It fills...
Okay. You're trying to complete the thought there? It fills?
I'm...
You're being distracted. Okay.
This is a Visser troll that we've got
in
here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry to hear that. Okay. I'll just continue here. He was probably familiar with Aesop's fables, since he contrasted John the Baptist's unyielding nature to a reed shaken with the wind, Matthew 11:7, implying instead that he opposed Herod like an oak tree in the parable of the oak and the reed. Another parable of Aesop is the fox in the vineyard, whose moral is similar to Jesus' remark about it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. I think all of this commentary here simply suggests that the entire Middle East, the Tigris and Euphrates area, and Greece, and Rome, and Northern Europe by the time of the Gospels was already populated by the migrating tribes of Israel. Okay? And that even Aesop's fables would be included in the literature. Mm-hmm. Okay? Whatever language that was composed in. Okay? All right. Based on the Hebrew structure and words which show up underneath the Greek, most of the Gospels were composed in Hebrew first. When we translate the books of Matthew and Mark, Luke back into Hebrew, we notice many word plays which were very common as a means to help the Israelites facilitate memorization. Very interesting. Very interesting. And the theologians simply refer to these expressions as Hebrewisms, right? Which reflect uh-huh. Hebrew idioms cast into
the
Greek.
The idiomatic use in the Hebrew is the most complicated. Now, Lamsa did a complete study of the Hebrew idioms. I'd like to get a copy. I think it might be online.
Mm-hmm.
But the book is no longer published.
Right.
I would love...
Lamsa's Aramaic Bible? Or yeah.
No, he did a study on the Hebrew idioms only. It was a complete book.
Okay, a book on that subject.
And I just took care of the problem on the chat room.
Okay, because so. I do have his Aramaic Bible.
You know, yeah.
Which translates okay. from the
George Lamsa. Yeah.
Exactly.
He's brilliant.
Yes.
Very brilliant.
Yes. Okay, so. We're going to switch now to tracing the dispersion, but first I just want to take care of a side issue that, I and David James were talking about the letter J and how yes. it originated into, how it came into the English language, because it wasn't until the 1600s
That's
that
correct.
The letter J was substituted for the letter I. You know, so where did it come from? Well, I had a chance to do a little bit of research. There actually isn't a letter. It's a different pronunciation of J. It's the J sound, the ZH. It's like in the English word beige. Okay? It's not beige. It's beige. So this pronunciation of J and J came into the English language from other languages. And I have been able to find out that it comes it was coming from the Persian language. It had the zh sound, okay. Chinese has the zh sound, so it was probably one of the original sounds that was sent around the world in the various migrations of various peoples. But it was left out of English and Greek, which only had the y, and Hebrew apparently too.
Right,
okay.
That's right.
The yes sound. So, and then this article here, dictionary.com, recently we asked you to let us know which of the 26 letters of the alphabet you'd like us to investigate. A resounding number of you suggested the consonant J. From its humble beginnings as a Roman numeral to its eventual 10th position in the English alphabet, J has had quite a linguistic history. And what it started out as in Roman numerals like XII, which is 12.
Right.
Okay. They for 13, they used a little squiggle, a jot or a tittle. Squiggle.
Yacht or a tittle.
Yeah.
And Pastor Dan puts the German jot.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Thank you, Dan.
Yes. And so, yeah, J is pronounced like a Y in German.
That's right.
Okay. And used to be the same in English as well. Like King James. It was originally.
Well, they have hallelujah.
That's right.
With a J.
With a J.
It is allelu. Uh-huh. Praise be to Yah. Y-A-H.
Yes.
The
yeah.
epithet for Yahweh. Praise
yes.
be to Yah.
Exactly. With a J. Right, so it's even in English, in many cases, it's still pronounced like a Y, okay? Or originally an I, okay? So when they concluded a Roman numeral, so they would put a substitute a J for the I at the end just to designate that that's the end of the number, okay? So
right.
the number.
Dan just put that in the chat room. Germans substituted J for the Greek I.
Uh-huh, very good.
He's got his act together.
Well, we in identity, we know our stuff, man.
Well, I mean, we got these guys who have been studying for so many years, and,
right.
and Dan's one of them.
Yes.
I mean, he's been around like, you know, forever.
Yes. Yeah. So
old
and then,
school, dude.
Right.
Old school.
Yeah. Right. So that's why we pronounce Jesus Yahshua. Because, you know, there's no blasphemy involved there. That's the original pronunciation of his name.
Yeah.
Yahshua.
Yah
not
is
Jesus.
Salvation.
Yeah.
Yah is salvation. Yah, and
yeah.
then Shua is salvation.
Right. And so it turns out both I and J, the origin of the letter J was, as I just described, it has with an I with a little squiggle to designate the end of a Roman numeral, okay? Both I and J were used interchangeably by scribes to express the sound of both the vowel and the consonant, and it was always yeah. It wasn't J. That's recent. It wasn't until 1524 when Gian Giorgio Trissino, an Italian Renaissance grammarian known as the father of the letter J, made a clear distinction between the two sounds. Trissino's contribution is important because once he distinguished the soft J sound, as in jam, probably a lone sound, he was able to identify the Greek Jesus, a translation of the old Hebrew Yeshua, as the modern English Jesus. Thus, the current...
See, they have put Yeshua.
Right. Yeah.
It's Yah.
It should be Yahshua, Shua. Exactly.
They
right.
have changed that.
Right.
They have tried every way they can try to pervert.
Yes.
They do. That
right.
they just right. won't let it go.
So, anyway, I thought it was very interesting to find out who the guilty party was. Gian Giorgio Trissino in 1524 invented the or brought the J sound into our European languages, although it probably existed in the Persian as a zh sound, not as a J sound, but as a zh sound, okay? And that's still pronounced that way in French. Okay, it's still pronounced with the ZH, as we have in du jour, right? Or in beige, that
ZH. That's what you were talking about earlier, je suis.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly, okay. All right, so just a note there for people who are curious about how the letter J, and, you know, because we have a lot of people, in fact, who was the guy out in Colorado, I can't think of his name right now. He said, Jesus is the only name that you can go by. And if you're not using the name Jesus, you're an infidel, right? No, I'm sorry. The apostles didn't use the name Jesus. They used Yahshua.
Sure.
Okay. They used Yahshua.
Yeah.
All right. So he's condemning the apostles to hell. Okay. All right. Now, tracing the dispersion. From my website, www.anglo-saxonisrael.com. This is
okay,
an article.
Okay, where are we done with this one? This,
yes.
This lesson 19?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll zap that out.
Right.
And here we are by
yeah.
Terry Blodgett.
Right. We're transitioning from English derived from Hebrew to German derived from Hebrew. And of course, English and German are related. Actually, English is half German and half Hebrew. And we're
uh-huh.
going to find out that German is half Hebrew and half Persian. That's what we're going to find out, okay? Because why? Because the Germans are derived from Pharaoh's Judah, who stayed in Persia slash the Tigris-Euphrates area, right, the land between the two rivers, and much longer than the other Israelites. They were the last, like Odin, was one of the last to leave the Middle East in the migration. So they stayed there the longest, and they picked up a lot of local dialect, such as the Persian language. Okay? So linguistic evidence in Europe, I'm going to drop down to that heading. From the Old Testament and other historical sources, such as the Annals of the Assyrian Kings, we learn that the Northern Kingdom, after years of war and deportation, fell to Assyrian invaders in 721 BC. And a lot of it we found out with Odin, a lot of Odin's terminology came from Assyria. The word Asgard is actually derived from the word Assyria, okay? That's where our people were. But in actual fact, he says 721 BC, the half-tribe of Manasseh was taken captive in 745 BC, which was 24 years earlier, okay? So I don't know if he's aware that the deportations began in 745 BC. Jeremiah emphasized the north countries as being these Israelites' eventual destination. And he gives various verses from Jeremiah. And implied a western route. See Jeremiah 18 and Hosea 12. Thus, a natural place to look for what befell those remnants is to study the countries north and west of the Middle East, otherwise known as Mesopotamia. It is of interest, therefore, to learn that in Europe, the centuries following 700 BC were marked by tremendous outside influence, and language was profoundly affected. Okay, Pastor Steve, wouldn't we expect this to happen once the Israelites started migrating into Europe?
Oh, of course. Look how the language is different in different parts of this continent with this massive landmass.
Yeah.
I mean, different parts of the country. You go up into the Northeast, you can't hardly understand a lot of the people.
That's right. Yeah, I can hardly understand David James at times. Just kidding.
And open the door and he walks.
And when Paul English gets and when Paul English gets rolling with his Cockney, right? He can speak the Queen's English with the best of them, and you know, and I have to listen carefully. What did he just say? During the period between 700 and 400 BC, numerous languages in Europe underwent major pronunciation changes and absorbed new vocabulary, which is what we would expect.
That's what I just said. Oh,
okay,
man.
Right. Okay.
Am I smarter?
Yeah, right. All right. This was particularly true of the Celtic languages, which were originally spoken throughout Europe, 700 to 300 BC. And as we have been telling you, folks, the Celts derived from the Israelite dispersion from Egypt, starting around 1500 BC. Yeah. And they actually migrated by sea to southern Europe, to Britain, to Spain, to Ireland, to Scotland, Scotta,
right.
Okay, and to Wales.
There were early departures from Mitzrayim,
right,
from Egypt, before the big exodus. Okay?
That's right, before
the
exodus.
They were going to the seacoast, making reed boats, and just, you know, they were doing trade. They were not oppressed or anything at that point.
Yes.
And they just went all over the place.
Right. So these Celts, the people known as Celts to the scholarly world, are in fact Israelites.
They're Celtoi.
They're the Israelites of the 1500 BC migration from Egypt, ruled over by Zerahjuda. Okay? And there was a high civilization, very high civilization, which you would expect from Israelites. Okay, so when the Germanic migration started, it was two branches of the same people, one pre-Exodus, one post-Exodus, that came together, often violently, right? Wars and battles, until they settled down. Hey, and realized, hey, we're brothers. But they spoke different versions of Hebrew, namely the Brythonic or Celtic Hebrew versus their Germanic Anglo-Saxon Hebrew. All right? Mm-hmm. And they eventually merged together in Britain when the Angles and Saxons left the Jutland Peninsula with some Jutes, by the way, Germanic Jutes, and invaded England. And this, now we have English, which is a combination of the two.
Angle-ish.
Yes, English. And so English, and we've showed that English is derived from Hebrew.
Man of the Angli, man of the Angli, Angle-ish.
Yeah, right, the Angles and the Saxons, which were primarily of Ephraim and Manasseh, I'm pretty sure.
That's okay. Correct.
With Judah, with the Jutes accompanying them as well. Okay? All right. So let's continue. So this is precisely what we would expect from the migrating Israelites, that they would have different dialects of Hebrew and forget their Hebrew origins over, what, 2,000 years? But not entirely.
Yeah, buddy.
Not entirely, because we quoted.
And here we are.
Mm-hmm. And here we are, right? And we're discussing history, which nobody else seems to be interested in except those of us in identity, right? Because this is our heritage, folks. All right. So the Celtic languages, which were originally spoken throughout Europe, because why? Because the Celtic languages are the Hebrew of the Egyptian migration. That's what Celtic is. But gradually became more concentrated in Western Europe and Britain, and of the Germanic languages, which were spoken in Central and Northern Europe and Scandinavia, and eventually in England. The gradual evolving of the sounds that make up words in a language, particularly when the two languages merge, is known by linguists as a sound shift. Okay?
Well, sound shift. Pastor Dan say, and I agree that Welsh
mm-hmm.
is virtually Hebrew.
Right.
Okay?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, you have to have a ton of bricks fall on you to wake up.
Right? I guess so.
I mean, a lot of people just are in denial.
Yes.
And
we left denial.
We left denial and said, I was just going to do that. You beat me to it.
You set me up. All right. Okay. The well-known pronunciation changes of the period of time between 700 and 400 BC have been called the Germanic sound shift because they were the most pronounced and systematic in the German languages, which include English, Dutch, German, Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, and Icelandic. All right? Now, he hasn't said anything about Hebrew yet. No. Also, during the same period, the total vocabulary in the Germanic languages increased by as much as one-third. Now,
A lot of new words. Right, well, we have a lot of new words in English today.
That's right. Well, as the people migrated, they would pick up, you know, words from the locale, all right? And if they encountered other peoples, they would pick up their words as well, okay? And they would make up words as they go along because they're an inventive people. They make new items. They give them names, right? So that's why our languages evolve and the languages of the Africans have stayed the same for the last 6 million years. Linguists have pondered what caused this sound shift and the increase in vocabulary. One theory is that the technologically advanced peoples who introduced iron to Europe, and we talked about tin, that you know, the pig iron and pig tin, they stamped the word, what was the word they stamped on there? Stan. Meaning tin. Also influenced the language changes. Linguistic research supports this idea, as well as the idea that these advanced peoples came from the Middle East, from Mesopotamia, where iron was in use. This research shows that the changes in language resulted from an influx of, underline this, folks, you want to say it?
Hebrew-speaking people
into Europe, okay? Now, Again, this destroys the academic model, which says that Hebrew and the Indo-Aryan languages are unrelated. What Blodgett is saying is the exact opposite, that these language changes derive from Hebrew. It was a Hebrew-speaking people that migrated. Now, who might those people be, Pastor Steve?
Scratch your head. It might be us.
It might be us, right? It just might be Israel, folks. Caucasian, yeah. Israel. All right.
Let me read
the whole sentence. The research shows that the changes in language resulted from an influx of Hebrew-speaking people into Europe, particularly into the Germanic and Celtic-speaking areas, which, and my argument, Pastor Steve, is simply that Celtic is Hebrew undergoing changes as they migrated from Egypt to Western Europe, the coastal regions of Europe, and later migrated into Central Europe. That's how the Celts migrated. Okay, from the south of the Mediterranean area into Central Europe.
And the Germanic languages, therefore,
came from the east.
Evolved into what we have as German today,
right?
With changes over time from the Hebrew, correct?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And we can generally say that the Celtic version of Hebrew came with Zarajuda. As Zarajuda migrated into Europe, okay? And the Germanic, that is the Anglo-Saxon version of Hebrew, came with the Pharaoh's Judah, who stayed in the Middle East, and the Parthian kingdom. All right? Mm-hmm. The Parthian kingdom was a huge kingdom, rivaling Rome.
When they separated, over time, the language drifted slightly apart.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would.
As a local dialect. It was a colloquialisms, et cetera, came in from that area where they were living.
Yeah, I see.
But back in the beginning, it was all one root people.
Yes, yes. Okay, several people are putting links to the Aramaic and idioms of the Bible explained. The chat room is really hopping with links that but we can't go into those. We got too much to do here, but it shows that there's a lot of literature on this subject which has been totally ignored by language scholars, by the secular language scholars. Okay, so let's continue. So we have this sound shift, and so we see that this Germanic sound shift, because they were the most pronounced and systematic in the German languages, which include English, Dutch, German, Danish, Swedish. I think I read that already.
Right.
So linguists have long pondered what caused this sound shift and the increase in vocabulary. Okay, scratch our heads. Yes.
Instead of saying, now I'm going to have to consciously check. Fire,
right?
F-I-R-E.
Fire,
we going over in the woods. We're going a lot of far,
right?
And F-A-R.
Yes, sir. Right.
Or F-A-H-R. Far. Yeah. Well, that's because I've been on the radio, my southernisms have pretty much disappeared.
Right.
Not all of them.
Yeah, you have to speak English so everybody can understand.
I slip back into it, right. And y'all just going to have to put up with that.
You went far into the woods to light a fire. Now, wait a minute.
Well,
what'd you say?
That's like the Israelites. You got your northern Israelites, and they say
Yankees.
Shalom.
Right.
They say shalom and peace when they greet you.
Right.
Shalom. And you get your southern Israelites and they say shalom, y'all.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So now there's an entire section on the Germanic sound shift here. Most of the languages of Europe belong to the Indo-European family of languages. And what we found is that the Indo-European languages are, in fact, derived from Hebrew. We proved that in the first two segments of this series. That is, they are part of the linguistically linked group of languages spoken in Europe and spreading as far east as Iran and India, right? And we proved that the sons of Abraham were in India, don't you know?
That's right.
Okay. For many years, the peculiarities...
Well, the Brahmin.
That's right. Okay. The Brahmins.
Brahmi.
Mm-hmm.
Brahmi.
Exactly. And they're the ones who brought the sacrificial rituals into India, you know, sacrificing right. bulls.
And they, when they mixed
right.
with the indigenous, they were no longer pure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the mess that they are today is like anywhere else where you got white people that right. have that messed with the Cachahundas that live local.
That's right. Yeah. And we know for a fact that it was the sons of Abraham that created a caste system. They tried to stay separate for generations, you know, until finally right. they did mix together. So the upper caste of India was, in fact, derived from Abraham, the Abraham and Keturah. And there's even
all
a,
right, let, yeah. let's just go into Mexico. You got a group of people in Mexico that they call La Raza, mm-hmm. the race. They're the really white Mexicans, and they won't marry in mm-hmm. with the little brown ones.
Right.
They've and they're the upper class. They separate. They're the Spanish.
Yes.
Mexicans.
Who were originally white? They were originally Israelites.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
But they've tried to separate from the others. They haven't been entirely successful.
Right.
But they still try to hold to that tradition, and they call it La Raza, the race.
So you see happening in Mexico exactly what happened to India.
All this has been going on.
That's
and,
right.
They won't. And there's entire communities down in Mexico that are German.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
White, blonde-haired, blue-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
And they speak German.
That's
and they
right.
won't marry with the indigenous population.
In Argentina as well.
And they yes, and they
large
stay
German
separate.
Population.
They have their
they
own
stay separate.
German festivals.
Yes.
And a little bit in Argentina, as you said, is the same way.
Uh-huh. And that's where Hitler went. He didn't die in Germany. He went to Argentina and, you know, spent the rest of his life with his German brothers in Argentina. Okay. The CIA is fully aware of this, but that's another story.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So, for many years, the peculiarities of the Germanic languages kept linguists from recognizing that the Germanic languages belonged to the Indo-Aryan group. However, early in the 19th century, two linguists, Rasmus Rask from Denmark and Jakob Grimm from Germany, I wonder if he's one of the Grimm brothers.
Rastus who?
Rasmus Rask.
Oh.
And Jacob Grimm.
You said Rastus.
Rastafarian. Jacob Grimm from Germany showed that the Germanic languages were indeed part of the Indo-European family, but that their differences in pronunciation were caused by a systematic shift in the sound of two groups of consonants, namely PTK and BDG, which are very similar, okay? P is similar to B, T is similar to D, K is similar to G. And so what he's saying here is that one group of consonants displaced the other. At the time of the sound shift, the pronunciation of these six consonants was changed to PH, TH, KH, which would be, that would be your Hebrew, right? With the H sound as part of the K sound. Okay, like Chabad Lubavitch. Okay, and the Germanic retains that Hebrew, that CH sound. And BH, DH, and GH, and GH is common to Sanskrit as well, respectively. These new sounds were usually represented in writing by the letters F, TH, H, or X, or CH, and B, substituted with V, D, T, H, and G, G, H. All right, so we see there's a subtle difference in pronunciation of the known consonants. For example, by applying the rules of the sound shift to the Indo-Aryan tepuk, replacing the TP and K with TH, F, and X, we recognize the English words the fox.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So Indo-European, tepuk. And do you get any Hebrew connection here from tepuk, Pastor Steve? Because we know that the Germanic introduced more of the Hebrew-style pronunciation. Okay.
Well, what they have here, they have the Hebrew word for Spain, Sepharad, and now it's a Sepharad. It's a slight. The word for sign, spelled O, was pronounced spelled ought. Was pronounced ut.
Okay.
Well, it's a very subtle t.
Mm-hmm.
It's subtle.
Yes. And we still have in English the word ought, and it's a related word not, meaning zero.
Nothing, yes.
Nothing. Okay. So that derives from the Hebrew. Okay.
No sign of it, you know, that's not.
That's right. No sign of it. Okay. No. Sign everywhere.
I mean, it's the evidence here is absolutely overwhelming.
Yeah, this is, I find this fascinating how the Indo-European words get transliterated into the English. Tepuk the fox. So, and we see all of this comes from the original Hebrew. And I think also I have to say, because our Israelite ancestors spent so much time in northern Mesopotamia, where Aramaic was the lingua franca, okay? So they would have picked up a lot of Aramaic, and they would have picked up a lot of Persian and Syrian, and it's the Persian and Syrian additions that define the Germanic, okay? And I did an interview a few years ago with an Israelite who actually went to Persia and listened carefully to the language those people were speaking, and he said, these people are speaking German. Okay, he could recognize the German in the Persian right away. So that's where our people picked it up from. That's where we got the Germanic pronunciations and words from. All right, let's continue. Now the relationship between the Indo-European word pater, and you can that still exists in the Latin as pater.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
father.
And, yeah, and in German it's Vater. With a V, Vater, okay? And English becomes father with a TH, father, okay? So somehow the T of Vater got replaced with a TH of father with the extended TH sound, father, right? So
well, the P from Pater could be a F.
Right? Yeah.
If it's a PH sound.
Yes.
Okay. Depends on the local area.
So we see that the Germanic retains the Hebrew vau or vav, okay, the softer sound, okay, and somehow the F sound was introduced from the English, okay, but it was actually an F sound for the letter V originally anyhow. Okay, it's just a slight different pronunciation with the TH sound becoming more pronounced.
That's right.
Linguists generally agree that these changes began taking place sometime after 700 BC. Why would that be? Why would it be sometime after the Israelites were taken into the captivity by the Assyrians? You think there's a relationship there, Pastor Steve? Or is this coincidences?
They moved them north, and some escaped, and some got in boats, and some
the Celts
rode camels or donkeys or walked, and they migrated up into Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they through the Pass of Israel and the Caucasus Mountains, and scattered all over. I mean, they just right. walked all over. They were went to the United States, the continent here.
Yeah.
There's stones, stela, and cave writings that are in Paleo Hebrew here in the United States.
Yes, that's right.
That are so old. I mean, in this, you know, they just try to deny,
yeah.
hide, lie.
Mm-hmm.
They want to deny our birthright, and we're yes. just not going to let them.
Yes. Pastor.
Ain't happening, y'all.
Yeah. Okay. A couple of comments here from the chat room. Pastor Dan says Greek X is the CH sound. Okay.
Yeah.
And Scottish loch actually sounds like lock, but in the Hebrew it would be pronounced loch. And Germanic preserves a lot of that Hebrew CH.
Yeah, it sure does.
Loch. All right. In Dutch, vater is vader. I'm not sure he spells it with a V. I'm assuming it's pronounced like an F, vader, with a harder D rather than a T. Or a TH, okay? So we see in the various dialects of English, all derived from Hebrew, we see that the various dialects of the Indo-Aryan Hebrew languages, let's just call it the Aryan Hebrew languages.
There you go.
The Aryan Hebrew languages all have variations of these original Hebrew words. That's what we're demonstrating here, folks, okay? So, sometime after 700 BC, oh, by the way, I actually meant to reference the Cimmerioi rather than the Celts, because the Cimmerioi, Cimmerian wave was in between the Egyptian wave and the Anglo-Saxon wave of migration. They left the Cimmerioi, named after King Omri, were Israelites of northern Israel of Samaria, you know, this is Samaritan lands of Israel, who escaped prior to the invasion of the Assyrians because they saw it coming. All right? So they got into their boats, and went straight west across the Mediterranean, and many of them settled in Wales, who are the Cymry. All right?
Cymry,
named after King Omri, folks. So between the Egyptian migration of Israel and the Anglo-Saxon Germanic migration of Israel was the Cimmerioi migration, all of these people being direct descendants of the 12 tribes of Israel, okay? We have traced these migrations absolutely as much as we possibly can, and we've been identifying the European nation states that derive from these Hebrew Israelite tribes, okay? We've just been focusing on the languages for the last two shows, okay? So, and it says that the influence causing the sound shift continued to affect the Germanic dialects for several centuries, at least until 400 BC, and possibly as late as the Christian era. Unfortunately, scholars have not been able to agree upon what caused these changes or where the original homeland of the peoples may have been. Okay. Well, even our DNA takes us back to Mesopotamia. Even the R1, which is the DNA of the white race, takes us back to Mesopotamia. And I've had my own DNA studied, and many others who have, they trace themselves to, and my maternal DNA traces back to some woman from Mesopotamia. All right, maybe Sarah, maybe Rebecca, right? But that's where our people were. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Jews came from Edom to the south of Judah. So they would have completely different DNA, and they do. All right, they don't have Israelite DNA. They have Edomite DNA. All right? So he continues, yep. Scholars have traced them to the Black Sea area and to the Caucasus Mountains, surprise, surprise. But research did not trace them beyond there because the scholars did not know whether there had been people's first homeland, or they had come from the east or the south of that point. Okay, let me interject here. The common misperception of the secular pagans, white pagans, and others, secular white people, assumes that the Nordics migrated south and influenced the civilization of Mesopotamia. The exact opposite is true. The fact, because they assume that because they believe that the Hebrews are Jews with hooked noses and crooked teeth and receding foreheads. Okay, no, the Israelites are not Jews. You've got it wrong. As we've been demonstrating here, the Nordic people derive from Israel because the Israelites were white Adamic people, not hook-nosed, receding forehead Jews. Get that straight once and for all. Okay? So, and because of these false assumptions, these linguists have no idea that Hebrew is the informing language of all of the so-called Indo-Aryan languages. They have no idea, all right? My research took me to the Middle East, and it was there that I found a likely cause for the sound shift. The Hebrew language. The first thing I noticed was that Hebrew shifted the same six consonants, I almost said continents, that were shifted in Germanic, PTK and BDG. In ancient Hebrew, these consonants carried a dual pronunciation. Often they did not shift, but when they began a syllable that was preceded by a long vowel, such as Isaac, he doesn't mention the word Isaac, but it was shortened in German, it's Saka, and it became Sake in the Middle East. They just simply dropped the long vowel. Or ended a syllable, then PTK and BDG shifted to the sounds of PH, TH, KH, and BH, DH, GH. So there was a rule. You could see that there was a tendency which became a rule of pronunciation. So you could see that this shift was occurring on a regular basis. Thus, the Hebrew word for Spain, Sepharad, was pronounced Sepharad. And the word for sign spelled Ot, which you mentioned already, was pronounced Ot. In 700 BC, this sound shift was still functional in Hebrew and would have been part of any impact that migrating Israelites would have had on other languages. Thank you very much. Okay.
That is correct. Yes, sir. I mean, this is a good article.
Yeah.
I like
it. And this guy, I don't know if he's identity or not, but you know, he's done his research. The fact that the same consonants were involved in similar sound shifts in both Hebrew and Germanic dialects at about the same time is significant. Yet even more significant is that the sounds PH, TH, KH, and BH, DH, GH, so prevalent in Hebrew, did not exist in Germanic before the sound shift occurred.
Sound shift occurred, yes.
Okay. All right.
Oh, my.
So now who would have brought the Hebrew language into, and so my position, Pastor Steve, is that what's called Germanic is really derived from the Persian. And, you know, so what happened was with the Parthian Empire, more Hebrew began to be infused into the Persian. Let's continue. A comparison of Hebrew and Germanic. The case for a Hebrew influence on Germanic is further strengthened by a close comparison of the two languages, and particularly of the changes that developed in Germanic following the Assyrian captivity of Israel. So now we can trace the actual physical migrations of our Caucasian Israel ancestors and the changes in our languages. The changes fall generally into three categories: pronunciation, grammar, and vocabulary. Number one, pronunciation. In addition to the similar sound shifts just described, there were other sounds common to both Hebrew and Germanic, as we would expect, because we know they're related people. They are the same people, in fact, that did not generally appear in the Indo-European languages. Okay, why? Well, because Keturah's sons were sent east, and they would have developed a different dialect of Hebrew from those who stayed in Assyria. That's to be expected. Okay. For example, when Hebrew and Germanic consonants appeared between vowels, they normally doubled the preceding vowel if the preceding vowel was short, so a double L as opposed to a single L. This doubling of consonants, referred to as gemination, G-E-M-I-N-A-T-I-O-N, gemination, became a characteristic feature of Germanic, but not of other Indo-European languages. Why? Well, the ones that migrated from Sanskrit India, which is Sanskrit is a version of Hebrew, would have taken an eastern northerly route, whereas the Germans took the Caucasian route. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the general distinction between the Scythians, who were also Hebrews and Israelites, but they were in further east. They were further east of the 12 tribes, where the 12 tribes had lived. But they just migrated further east. They went around, I think it was the Caspian Sea. They went around the Caspian Sea and not through the Caucasus. So if these tribes are living, well, in this case, it would be several hundred miles apart, you would expect them to develop different dialects. All right? And then, and of course, the Scythians were not too far from the Mongols, and the Tatars and people like that, who they might have picked up some words from as well, while they were killing each other. In this way, Indo-European Media became Old English Middle, and actually, Old English, it says M-I-D-D-E-L. In German, it's Mittel, M-I-T-T-E-L.
That's right.
And modern English, middle. Okay.
Right. Well, media means the middle, the medium.
Mm-hmm.
Not on either end in the center. It's more centrist.
Mm-hmm.
And then the middle, and then middle.
Mm-hmm. So you see that almost half of the Hebrew verb conjugations required doubling the consonant and substituting a shortened vowel preceding the consonant. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Compare Hebrew shabar, to break, and the related mm-hmm. Hebrew form shiber, which is a double B, to shatter.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, almost half of the Germanic verbs doubled the middle consonant and substituted a shortening preceding vowel. All right? Indo-European sad and bad, or actually sad and bad, became satan set, or bidan bid in Old English. Bitte auf Deutsch. Please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Please.
All right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Number two, grammar. Oh, I see we're just about at the end. I got really involved in this here. Okay.
Yeah, we better quit. We'll pick this up the next time.
Yeah, yeah. So what we're demonstrating here, yeah, and we'll complete this essay next week, and that should complete our language studies for this series, because what we wanted to demonstrate is that all of the Nordic languages, so-called, which includes, Danish, Swedish, German, right, Finnish, etc., we have demonstrated that they all derive partially from the Hebrew, okay?
They have evolved from the Hebrew, yeah. Yes.
They have evolved from the Hebrew. And Terry Blodgett is explaining how the pronunciation habits of the Hebrew were carried forward by the Germanic into somebody's language. Now, they weren't picked up by all of the Nordic languages, but the fact remains, folks, that the so-called Indo-Aryan languages are, in fact, derived from Hebrew, and so are the Celtic languages, the Brythonic languages. So is German, as he is demonstrating here very clearly, because he says that this sound shift comes from Hebrew idioms, and Hebrew pronunciation habits. All right? So anybody who says that Hebrew is not related to the Indo-Aryan languages simply does not know what he or she is talking about.
Well, and a lot of them want to deny our roots.
That's right.
They have an agenda, and they'll put in it's sort of trolling.
Yes.
When they do that, they're trying to twist.
Yeah, and of course the Jews encouraged them. The Jews encouraged them by, because the Jews don't want the Nordics to understand that they're Israelites. Okay, that's the last thing the Jews want. All right.
They're finding out. That's all I can say.
All we can do is keep on teaching until they get it. All right, folks.
Out of the bag.
Yes. Hot. That's hot. All right, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll complete this study next Sunday. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you next time.
Yeah. Shalom Aleichem, my brothers.